Systems theory tells us that if you change one part, you change the whole. That if you change one part, you affect everything. So think of your family as a system, and you're traveling on vacation on some rural road, and you see a sign that says, free puppies. Now, there's no such thing as a free puppy, but you stop, and you get this beagle into your car, and you take the beagle home, and everything in your family changes, starting with the living room carpet and moving on to your budget, because now you have to buy dog toys and dog food and a dog bed, and you have to pay veterinary bills for the dog. And your schedule changes because you need to get up early in the morning to walk your beagle and late at night to take your dog for a walk. And you're happier because now you have a new friend that is part of your family, and the whole system has changed. Or suppose that you finally get around to something that you've been meaning to do for a very long time, and that is to check the pressure on your tires and bring your tires up to the full inflation that is recommended by the manufacturer. And when you get around to doing that, that means then that your tires will last longer and you will save money, and that you will get more miles per gallon. Now you have money in your pocket, so now you can go out to eat at a better restaurant, and you'll meet some more interesting people, and your life will never again be the same because you have the right pounds per square inch in your tires. Change one part of the system, and you change it all. But let's not talk about dogs and tires. Let's talk about Christian faith. Suppose that you are part of a pagan community, and you as a Christian, or with your family, move in where Christians have not previously been, and that changes your neighborhood, or you're a new employee at the company, or a new student in the classroom, and everything is different because you are there as a Christian. That's what happened in Ephesus. Ephesus was a large and important first century city. It is one of the most amazing ancient ruins that anyone could ever visit. You can walk down the streets, you can go into the homes, you can visit the library and the temples. It's all there for you to see, almost as if it were stuck in time. And we in the 21st century can go back and see what it was like. Prominent in the city of Ephesus was the goddess Artemis. Called by the Romans Diana, Artemis was said by the ancient Greeks to have fallen from heaven. And so there are historians who say that perhaps it was a meteorite that became the basis for the statue. In the temple of Artemis, which was so large and so magnificent that it was one of the seven wonders of the ancient world. The statue that fell from the sky, well, it represented all that Artemis was about. She was the goddess of fertility. Her entire body was lined with breasts. She was the goddess of hunting. She was the goddess of women, the virgin goddess who held a mother role. Extremely difficult for those of us in a different culture at a different time to understand how really important she was and the role that she played. But she dominated the ancient Ephesians. And then came Christianity. There is a simple but profound line in Acts 19:23 that says that about that time there arose a great disturbance about the way. One line that describes a revolution. That Christianity came to the city of Ephesus and it changed everything. That Jesus Christ and his teachings challenged the presuppositions and altered their pagan worldview. It touched every part of the city. And it's interesting, at least to me, that they weren't known as Christians and the gathering was not referred to as the church, but rather they were known as the way. Well, that's what Jesus said. I am the way and the truth and the life. Actually, it's not the title that is important to the followers of Jesus. It is the truth. It doesn't much matter by what name we are called, church or Christians or some denomination or label that is given to us. We are followers of the way. Convinced that all of humanity is seeking God, and that there are many quests that people have invented throughout history, but that the way of Jesus is the true way. And when that is said, that is upsetting, disconcerting, disturbing for those who have been following a different way to be told that Jesus is the right way. And so there was a buzz about Jesus and the way in the city of Ephesus, kind of like everyone was talking about it. Some arguing, some debating, some believing, some dreaming, some hoping. But there was a guild of silversmiths in Ephesus that became especially disturbed. What they did was they made silver souvenirs, trinkets. They were either depictions of the goddess Artemis or the temple of Artemis. And just as we go to Disney World and you get a silver charm of Mickey Mouse or Goofy, those who came to visit Ephesus would buy these silver charms. And the people that lived there wore them, had them in their homes. It was an important part of the economy of Ephesus. It was more than just a lucky charm. They believed that this was a source of divine blessing. But as Ephesians learned about the way of Jesus, sales of these silver souvenirs were slipping. And as they slipped, the industry was threatened. And we understand that. If you are in the business of manufacturing or selling film, then you've got to be threatened by digital photography. Worse yet, suppose you make your living repairing typewriters. I mean, just think what computers and printers have done to the typewriter industry. And so the silversmiths were frightened and looking for someone to blame. The president of their association was a man named Demetrius, and he decided to blame the followers of the way. A silversmith named Demetrius, who made silver shrines of Artemis, brought in no little business for the craftsmen. He called them together, along with the workmen in related trades. That's interesting because it, like tentacles through the economy, had subsidiary and related businesses. And he said to this gathering, "Men, you know we receive a good income from this business. And you see and hear how this fellow Paul has convinced and led astray large numbers of people here in Ephesus and in practically the whole province of Asia. He says that man-made gods are no gods at all. There is danger not only that our trade will lose its good name, but also that the temple of the great goddess Artemis will be discredited, and the goddess herself, who is worshipped throughout the province of Asia and the world, will be robbed of her divine majesty." Demetrius offered some persuasive arguments. He started out candidly, saying that this would mean a loss of income for those that were in the silversmith trade. But he didn't want to seem so crass as to say this is only about making money. And so he talked about the way infringing on the brand of Artemis, that this would diminish the brand in Asia and throughout the Roman Empire. And it would do more than that. It would be unpatriotic. It would defame the city of Ephesus. He predicted dire results from the loss of sales of these silver shrines. I don't know quite what you'd compare that to for us, but imagine if some foreigners came to America and were perceived as undermining the American flag. Now, we all know that the flag is made out of dyes of three different colors and fabric and threads that are sewn together. And it's material. It's just material. But when you put it together as an American flag, it means our history. It talks about our government. It is a source of emotional patriotism. It is tied to all kinds of memories and symbols within our society. And for an outsider, a foreigner, to come in and be perceived as attacking that which is so important in our culture is egregious. It's just downright offensive. Now, Demetrius didn't deal with the teachings of Jesus. He didn't mention them at all. He simply riled up the emotions and the patriotism of the people of Ephesus. It was a clever but deceptive tactic that has been used a million times since. And I think it's easy to criticize him. It's easy for me to criticize him. But, you know, I also imagine that if we were in his situation, that we might do precisely the same thing. Because we'd like to defend our jobs and our way of life and our culture. And when we are threatened by something or someone that comes from the outside, we are resistant to that change. So the silversmiths in their guild gathered and then expanded to a crowd of critics that incited a riot. When they heard this, they were furious and began shouting, "Great is Artemis of the Ephesians!" Soon the whole city was in an uproar. The people seized Gaius and Aristarchus, Paul's traveling companions from Macedonia, and rushed as one man into the theater. Paul wanted to appear before the crowd, but the disciples would not let him. Even some of the officials of the province, friends of Paul, sent him a message begging him not to venture into the theater. The assembly was in confusion. Some were shouting one thing, some another. Most of the people did not even know why they were there. The Jews pushed Alexander to the front, and some of the crowd shouted instructions to him. He motioned for silence in order to make a defense before the people. But when they realized he was a Jew, they all shouted in unison for about 2 hours, "Great is Artemis of the Ephesians." By the way, that was one of her nicknames, Artemis the Great. So the silversmiths started chanting in their guild hall, "Great is Artemis of the Ephesians." And then they kept that chant going as they poured out onto the Arcadian Way, this large marble paved boulevard that goes through the middle of Ephesus. And as they did, people in the shops and walking down the boulevard were attracted. And it was so engaging, so emotional, that they also started shouting the chant. It is a city loaded with hard surfaces. It is up against a mountain. And so the sounds ricocheted, reverberated off of the buildings. And everybody could hear the chant that was being yelled by this growing parade of people. So they came out of their doors. They looked out of the windows. And many of them then joined in the parade, until what started out as scores or hundreds multiplied out to become thousands. And the adrenaline was flowing. And newcomers kept joining the chant. And they moved toward an amphitheater, which is up against Mount Paion. I've been there. Many of you perhaps have been there as well. It is one of the most magnificent of ancient ruins. It's about 500 feet wide. It seats 25, some would say more than 25,000 people if they are all crammed in there together. I've sat there, and it's almost as if these chants echoed down through the centuries. You can see the exact place where all of this occurred. And it is exciting and kind of frightening to be there at the moment. When this crowd finally made it to the amphitheater, they were en route looking for the person to blame and wanted to find Paul. Apparently unable to find him, they instead seized two of Paul's traveling companions, a man named Gaius and another man named Aristarchus. They also were from out of town, from Macedonia in northern Greece, and they were the ones that were being accused of undermining not just the silversmith trade, but the belief in Artemis. The fears abounded. People were shouting, yelling. There was chaos. And a lot of people didn't even know why they were there. In the midst of all of this, there were Ephesian Jews, those that belonged to the local synagogue. And they were afraid that they were being blamed for what the followers of Jesus were actually doing. Because the distinction between a Jew and a Christian escaped the average Ephesian. We understand that. If you are part of a business or a union or a profession or a religion that has nuances to distinguish those that are on the inside, you recognize that people on the outside often do not get the subtleties and cannot tell the differences. And to the people of Ephesus, a Jew and a Christian were pretty much the same thing. The Jews, not wanting to take the blame, took one of their own, probably the president of the synagogue, a guy named Alexander, and pushed him up on the stage. And then they were outside the stage shouting instructions to him, and he was going to explain the difference between a Jew and a Christian. At first, he tried to outshout the crowd. When that didn't work, he signaled to them to be quiet, and there was enough of a lull until they realized that he was a Jew. And there was a lot of antipathy toward Jews in most major Roman cities. So when they saw he was a Jew, they wouldn't listen, and they started chanting all over again, "Great is Artemis of the Ephesians." And they did it for 2 hours. Imagine 2 hours of just repeating that same sentence again and again. Now, was all this simply because the teachings of Jesus had come to town? Yes, indeed. It was all because of the teachings of Jesus. Is the gospel of Jesus Christ that powerful? Yeah, it is that powerful. But they had misunderstood so much. Christianity is not about anarchy. It's about peace. It's not about people losing jobs. It's about helping them to get jobs. That they misunderstood. It wasn't about undermining the way to God. It was showing the true way to God. They misunderstood and misrepresented the way. And so Paul wanted to step up on the stage and correct the misconceptions. But that raised a question that I've thought about a lot. When you are misunderstood, as we are all misunderstood on a lot of things, including our Christian faith, is it better to answer the critics and come up and defend ourselves, or is it better to just keep quiet and trust God to take care of the misrepresentations over time? I've had that happen to me. People misunderstood what I've said or misquoted or spun it in a different direction or maybe flat out lied. Should I defend myself and straighten everybody out? Or should I keep quiet and just stick to the truth? Well, Paul wanted to straighten everybody out, up on the stage and tell the crowd the truth about Jesus. But his advisors, fellow believers, told him he shouldn't do that. You might find that kind of surprising. In fact, there were officials in the province of Asia who also advised him, who probably weren't yet Christians, but who knew Paul and said, just stay off the stage. Now, why would they do that? I was talking once to a nurse who works in a dementia ward, and she said to me, there is a principle that they go by, and the principle is you cannot have a rational conversation with an irrational person. Now, that's not in the Bible, although it should be. I mean, it would be good. It would be a good thing to put in the Bible. And I suppose in other ways it is sort of said in the Bible. But this crowd was irrational. And they were not open to reason. A rational conversation with them wouldn't work. So whatever Paul said, it was going to be spun in a different direction. It was going to be misquoted. It would probably make things far worse instead of far better. And the counsel he was given, and interestingly, the counsel that he followed was to just keep quiet, and that was the better approach. But what would Paul have said if he had spoken? Well, it's only a guess. But my guess is he would not have criticized the silversmiths of Ephesus. My guess is that he would not have attacked Artemis and those who worship her. My guess is that he would have simply explained that Jesus of Nazareth is the way and the truth and the life, and that you can have forgiveness of sin and a relationship with God that lasts forever through Jesus. That he would not have taken an approach of defending against that which was wrong, but rather promoting that which was right and true. And as Christians, we face that same choice. Is our message mostly against what is wrong, or is our message mostly for the good news of Jesus? Several weeks ago, we conducted a survey of Wooddalers to answer the question, what should Christians do to influence culture? And I expected that of the multitude of answers that were given, they would be organized into a dozen or more categories. I was wrong, because essentially, pretty much everybody said the same thing. And that is the way to influence culture as a follower of Jesus, is to live out Christian faith, to walk in integrity, to be honest and truthful, to speak a word for Jesus, to live out Christianity at work and at school and at home. You insisted that you should live Christianly to transform America and the world. When it came down to specifics, you wrote things like raise children to love and serve Christ. Be an advocate for the disadvantaged, ostracized, and weakest of society. Model Christ-like values and behavior. And one line that I think summed it all up. As we love God and people, our culture will be changed. The Christians of Ephesus did not fight or defend or argue against the crowd of critics. They simply lived a Christian way. What happened next was officially an action of a Roman politician. And although the New Testament does not say this, it seems obvious to me that God was behind what that Roman official said and did. The city clerk quieted the crowd and said, "Men of Ephesus, doesn't all the world know that the city of Ephesus is the guardian of the temple of the great Artemis and of her image which fell from heaven? Therefore, since these facts are undeniable, you ought to be quiet and not do anything rash. You have brought these men here, though they have neither robbed temples nor blasphemed our goddess. If then Demetrius and his fellow craftsmen have a grievance against anybody, the courts are open and there are proconsuls. They can press charges. If there is anything further that you want to bring up, it must be settled in a legal assembly. As it is, we are in danger of being charged with rioting because of today's events. In that case, we would not be able to account for this commotion since there is no reason for it." After he had said this, he dismissed the assembly. So this unnamed civil servant, who apparently was respected and trusted by the people of Ephesus, made four basic points. He said, Artemis is great. In essence, he was telling them, if this goddess is as good as you think she is, she should not be fearful of competition from some other teaching. Number two, that the Christians are innocent. They haven't robbed a temple. They haven't done anything blasphemous. They haven't broken any law. So you don't really have a case against them. Number three, Demetrius, if he thinks he has a case, then he can file charges in the courts and he can follow the path through the legal system. And the most important point of this city clerk was number four, that the Roman government is going to perceive this as an out-of-control riot. And while the Roman government was tolerant of a lot of things, civil disobedience was not one of them. And so they were at risk that the Roman army would come crushing down on Ephesus if this kind of behavior continued. So the riot that was so loud and boisterous ended in a whimper. And the people in the stadium went home, and went to bed. And we wonder, why would the historian Luke include this? He had a limited number of words and pages to work with. He had 1,000, 10,000 stories he could tell. Why would he tell this story? Well, even though the Roman Empire had a philosophy that was contrary and diametrically opposed to the kingdom of God, the Christians were not unpatriotic. They weren't out to cause people to lose their jobs. They weren't against the government. Luke wanted that word out. He wanted there to be an acceptance of Christianity within the context of the culture so that as believers in Jesus lived out their faith, it would have an opportunity to permeate the culture and then to transform it one person at a time. And this was an example that was meant not only for his first century readers, but for those of us in every century later. All right, so today is Labor Day weekend. And this is the time when we set aside a specific holiday for those who work to have a day off. I suppose you could say that we are the silversmiths of our time, we who work. And it raises for us the question, do we work mostly for the money? or for some goddess that we have loyalty to, or for Jesus. And as Christians, we must decide how to change our culture from its paganism to the way of Jesus. And I know, because I have heard it often, the statistics and the stories that portray the American culture as in great danger and great difficulty. But I will tell you that when I read the words of response to the question of how we should change our culture from you, I am hopeful and encouraged. Because what I discover is that here is a microcosm of the Christian community across America. You are those who are deeply committed to Jesus. You truly believe in the power of the gospel of Jesus of Nazareth. And you seek daily, not perfectly, but consistently, to live out that Christian faith in marriage, in family, at home, at school, and work, everywhere we go. And I am convinced with that kind of commitment and that kind of behavior, backed up by the Holy Spirit and the power of God, that then permeates our culture to change our culture for good and for Jesus. Father, we love our country and our culture and our generation. And we truly want to be the representatives, ambassadors of Jesus Christ in it. By your grace, may we represent the way of Jesus well to transform those around us for Jesus' sake. Amen.